oddly enough, I haven't had anyone from the state bar or someone in New Mexico that actually wants to challenge any of my assertions. That's the problem. Like, okay, you got a problem with a case. Let's talk about a case. Let's talk about what rule I have misstated or provided misinformation about. And that hasn't happened yet.
There's no such thing as cancel culture, right? That's what we're being told. It's just a figment of the right-wing imagination. It's another boogeyman invented by the vast right-wing conspiracy that Hillary Clinton famously talked about. Well, joining us in a moment on Conversations That Matter is going to be Professor David Clements, a returning guest. We've had him on here before, and he has now found himself in the crosshairs of the cancel culture warriors. It started with him speaking out on the mostly peaceful protests on January 6th, the thing that the media wants you to believe is an insurrection and a treason and a terrorism and a war and you know, all the rest of the hyperventilating that they've done, yet they haven't charged a single person with insurrection. That's interesting. But so he spoke out about that, and that put him in the crosshairs. Then he started speaking out about the election issues, and then he started speaking out about the face masks and the jabs, and now they're really after him. Professor Clements, thank you so much for joining with us. So tell us what happened with the situation at your university and how you got your class canceled.
Well, hey, Alex, great to be with you. Well, this started back for me back in January 9th when I stood up to the university for unfairly targeting conservatives on campus. And I've had a bit of a bullseye since then, and I've made some controversial claims about election fraud, and I've been monitoring all the unpopular issues that you're not allowed to talk about, and that's just made life a little bit more difficult for me. But despite all that, I was awarded with a prestigious award for teaching excellence at my college, and I was nominated for that same award last year, and I've only been teaching for 3 years. So 2 out of the 3 years, I've been kind of a who's who for the business college where I work. I was told that I had to wear a mask and collect the award, and I said I would not. And that started a conversation because our policy at my university is that you have to get the experimental drug vaccine by September something, it's coming up soon, or be subject to invasive testing every week. And I said I'm not going to comply with either of those mandates, and I had my legal constitutional reasons for not doing that. And also the mask policy, because we've had a full year to figure out whether or not the science truly supports mask wearing, or we should have wholesale lockdowns or focused lockdowns. And we've got literature that shows us that the states that don't have these draconian measures fare much better. And since we are at an institution of higher learning, I decided to follow the science and put my money where my mouth was. And as a result of not complying with these unconstitutional, illegal, and immoral policies, I was placed on emergency suspension, despite the fact that I've had terrific reviews over the past 3 years.
Wow. And so what exactly does an emergency suspension mean? And why do you think these policies from the university are unconstitutional?
Well, there's a couple things. One, when you look at the data historically, any time that you've had vaccine deaths from programs from FDA-approved drugs, we've usually seen a halt to that program. Swine flu vaccine in 1976 was halted after 32 deaths. And conservatively speaking, when we look at the VAERS data for the big three experimental jabs that we've got right now, we've got over 30,000 deaths, and that's conservative. That's just what we've reported, and we've got millions of injuries. So based on historical precedent, where we've halted programs for FDA-approved drugs, and conversely now we switch gears and we look at experimental vaccines that don't have approval, and they've only been in the market for about 19 months total, when most drugs take anywhere from 6 to 10 years to get FDA approval, I think this is a violation of the Hippocratic Oath. I think that we're putting students and faculty in harm's way. And since we're not complying with historic norms, the science, and the fact that we've never had a case on point that addresses this issue, I'm going to assert that it's unconstitutional based on a body of case law that I've reviewed. But it doesn't seem like we've got a justice system that's looking at these matters very closely.
Yeah, it is really interesting. I follow Sweden pretty closely. I spent a lot of years living there. Wife happens to be from there. And what I found fascinating was that while the rest of the Western world was losing its mind, the Swedes said, yeah, we're not going to do that. In fact, no mandates whatsoever. The government told them, don't wear a mask, folks. It's just really unhealthy for you to put a thing over your face all day. And so nobody wore a mask. And yet now they're down to basically zero deaths per day. Until very, very recently, they had a much lower vaccination rate than the United States. And I mean, they survived. In fact, they thrived throughout all this, and yet we're being told now that it's so essential that we do these things. Why did you decide to stand up, Professor, knowing full well, you know, that they were going to come after you, that they were going to target you? Why do you think it's important to stand up and to resist things that are unconstitutional, immoral, ridiculous, whatever? Why put yourself on the line in this way?
Well, I teach the law. I tell everyone how it's supposed to work. And the way that you make it work is by exercising and practicing a life where you get to experience the liberties and freedoms that we've been guaranteed under the Constitution and Bill of Rights. And if I'm going to see that those liberties and rights are being violated unceasingly, then it doesn't really set a great example for my students. So just because someone says to do something doesn't mean that you should do it. And so what I'm seeing here is a breakdown between natural law, laws that are supposed to be just and moral, and what's taken form in throughout the university and HR departments across the country, which is this thing called positive law, which is you got to follow it because we said so. And we've been doing as a country a lot of just following rules just because someone said so. And we never ask what's the source of the law. You know, a lot of these rules and regulations don't come up, they don't come from a state legislature. So those that write the law, we're not having representation from any of those folks. And that's a breakdown in just the system that we're all supposed to operate under. And the way that you restore that system is by advocating for it.
Well, before we get into whether you think there's any hope for restoring, a reasonable legal system based on natural law where rights are protected as our founders intended, they're targeting you in another way too. I mean, they're going for the jugular here. They went to the Bar Association, right? They're coming after you from that angle as well, like they did to Sidney Powell, like they did to so many others that got involved. Now, Michigan has been putting Sidney Powell through the ringer, former federal prosecutor, highly decorated. So what's the story with the Bar Association? What are the complaints and what happens from here?
Well, throughout the country, we've seen an evolution on the rules of professional conduct. And normally, attorneys regulate other attorneys, so we can file complaints against other members of the bar within the respective jurisdiction that we practice in. Or if you've hurt a client, they can file a complaint against you. In most states, we've amended that where any concerned citizen anywhere in the country can file a complaint. And after I gave a closing summation at Mike Lindell's Cyber Symposium, where all I did was refer to videos and play and showed evidence that's out there, that's indisputable. Everything that I talked about was presented on a screen behind me. I started getting many, many complaints from attorneys and just concerned citizens saying that that was seditious, it was treasonous, and that it was an incitement to violence. And they're saying, look, another January 6th event's going to happen because of the things that I'm saying. Now, mind you, I've reviewed all the evidence and I have a good faith basis and have First Amendment protections to comment on what I've seen. And just because someone doesn't agree with them doesn't mean you should use a rules-based regulatory system to punish me. And that's exactly what's going on here. So I thought these were silly complaints. I said as much in the initial response, but I can tell right now that the State Bar of New Mexico is pursuing them quite seriously. They actually referenced the sanction order out of Michigan against Sidney Powell and have started asking me all kinds of questions outside of the stuff that I've said. They want me to now answer for statements made by people like Joe Altman, who's before a Antifa federal judge in Colorado. And he was one of the people that was a whistleblower of sorts against Eric Coomer and his ties to Dominion. And so they're doing a full-scale attack. They're not working in good faith. And it makes me ask the question recently whether or not I can call upon concerned citizens to report those that are investigating me. These are attorneys. And I've given that some consideration.
Yeah, I mean, that's, I think, a really good question, a really good point. Are attorneys who are viciously persecuting other attorneys who are speaking out about things they think are important, like suspected elected fraud, are they subverting the legal profession? So what do you think? Is that something that you think should happen, or do you want to give it some more time? What do you think terms of what should happen to them?
Well, I'm thinking about it because I had the first letter that I got was made a demand because I've referenced the thousands and thousands of affidavits that I've reviewed that the State Bar said, hey, we want you to produce 5,000 affidavits to us. Now, this is based on what I did at the Cyber Symposium. They're literally asking me to provide every affidavit that's been filed in publicly available cases in the entire United States. That doesn't seem a little bit excessive, burdensome, untimely. Now, it's not to say that that doesn't exist, but I've been using evidence aggregators and entire websites that allow you to use a search function to locate those. And you can find thousands of them, and some of them you have to hunt down on your own. So every time I've made a statement on the numbers, I've been able to review and in good faith say, look, these numbers are accurate. But they're going to try to have me work to death to find the actual documents and package them. That was the request. So I asked for clarification. Are you in fact asking me to produce every affidavit in every single election fraud case filed in the United States? Because there's like 450 of them, and they don't realize that. But they cited a Michigan order. I said, well, let's start with Michigan. You've got 274 pages of affidavits out of Wayne County alone. I mean, so are we really going to do this? So I think that's a bit punitive. I think that's I've never heard of anything like that for me expressing my views. And more problematic is I'm not an attorney that's filed any of these cases. So they're actually holding a sanction order over my head in a different state for attorneys that could have filed a case. I say could have because Sidney Powell actually filed a case. Lynn Wood was also sanctioned. And he's not someone who filed a single pleading out of Michigan. And they're using that to triangulate, pivot, and attack me when all I've done is comment on their cases. That shows you how absolutely disgusting the profession has become. I'm going to have to seriously consider because the rules actually tell me that I've got a duty to report misconduct from all bar members. And these people that are investigating me are, in fact, bar members.
Yeah, this is just a whole can of worms here. I mean, What kind of chilling effect is this going to have on other attorneys? And I wonder, do we go back 4 years now and talk about all the Democrats who alleged that there was a huge Russian conspiracy to put Trump in office? I mean, how far does this go? And will this stifle, will this have a chilling effect on attorneys who really need to represent their clients, who need to speak out on important issues, who, of course, have a First Amendment right to speak out on issues of public importance? What kind of effect do you think this will have on the legal system and the legal profession?
Well, it depends on the attorney. I mean, I've been out on an island by myself for a while now, and I don't scare easy. But I do know that most attorneys that really, really care about their license and really, really want to go there, and the fact that we've devoted tens of thousands of dollars, hundreds of thousands of hours, if we add it all up, on what it took to study and obtain a law license, to get our Juris Doctorate. When you think about the time devoted to a career where you maintain it, and I've been doing this over a decade, and I've had an impeccable career. I mean, like I said, I've been nominated for teaching excellence 2 out of the last 3 years, prosecutor of the year. I've led agencies, and the fact that I'm being attacked so viciously and pursued, yes, it's absolutely going to have an effect on the attorneys out there, and I think that's why there's so few that are stepping up. Oddly enough, I haven't had anyone from the state bar or someone in New Mexico that actually wants to challenge any of my assertions. That's the problem. Like, okay, you got a problem with the case. Let's talk about a case. Let's talk about what rule I have misstated or provided misinformation about. And that hasn't happened yet.
Yeah, it's. I certainly don't think this is going to do a lot to strengthen the American people's confidence in the legal system or in the legal profession. If you look at the polling data, most Americans are losing confidence in our election system. Most Americans, including about a third of Democrats, admit that they have very serious concerns about what happened in the 2020 election. And so to now persecute lawyers who speak about this or who file cases, I think it's really going to further erode the American people's trust in the legal system. Professor, where do we go from here? Do we need wholesale reforms in the legal system, in the bar system, in the university system? What advice do you have to normal people, to lawyers? How do we get out of this as a country, if it's even possible anymore?
Well, if you've got crooks running the organization, you can have whatever reforms you want. They'll be meaningless. What we need are people that inhabit a spirit of justice and righteousness, right and wrong. And so the fact of the matter is, right now, anyone who's objective would understand that in my particular set of circumstances, there were at least 91 or 92 lawsuits that I closely examined out of the 450. By the rationale of the state bar that's coming after me, why haven't every one of the attorneys that filed lawsuits in those election fraud cases been sanctioned? If I'm relying on a lack of credible evidence with thousands of affidavits filed, why hasn't there been a single prosecution for perjury?
Yeah.
And so you look at these things and you just say, look, let's just look at the brick by brick components of the statements being made. But just because you don't like the fact that I voted for Donald Trump, just because you don't like my particular viewpoints, doesn't mean that I should be persecuted politically by the Bar Association. And so I think to solve the problem, we have to cut out the cancer of people that don't work in good faith. And I think the way that you do that is you have to nurture and cultivate an environment where truth is permissible. Opposing viewpoints are permissible. And right now, that's just not the landscape that lawyers work in.
Wow. Unbelievable what you're going through, Professor Clements. Any final words of wisdom? And then tell us how people can find you, how people can support you. I know you have a website. Please give that out. The professorsrecord.com, is that the best one? And just leave us with any final words of wisdom, maybe something hopeful if you have something. And how can people get involved and find you?
Well, you mentioned my website, theprofessorsrecord.com. At the bottom of that website, there's other links to my other social media platforms. I'm mostly on Telegram. As far as hope, I'm not going anywhere. I'm not going to quit. And it's one of those things where the Republic's worth fighting for. And what encourages me and provides me with hope is seeing other patriots take that risk. Because if we all realize how powerful we are collectively, and we all stood up at once, we would reclaim our republic right now. We would reclaim it tonight. We're just waiting for things to happen. And I say, don't wait on anyone else. Start acting in a way that's in accordance with the truth, and the truth will set you free.
Amen. Well, Professor, thank you so much. We appreciate you being here. Thank you for standing up and standing firm. Thank you for sharing your insight with us. Folks, that was Professor David Clements. Incredible former prosecutor, then professor, who has now put himself on the line to stand up for freedom of speech and what's right. So go check out his website, theprofessorsrecord.com. Thanks again for watching. This is Conversations That Matter for the New American Magazine. I'm your host, Alex Newman, and until next time, God bless.